Powerful at Work Radio, episode 58.
Welcome to Powerful at Work Radio, the podcast for business owners like you who want to lead from a place of love and create a whole new kind of business environment. I'm your host, Rosa Ponce de Leon, and together we'll explore how you can secure your legacy and make a real difference by having a relationship with your team that honors the unique value each person brings to your organization. It is my goal to help you find your leadership sweet spot so your team is empowered to be more creative and efficient without all the burnout and people issues. I hope these conversations will inspire you to embrace a people-first approach, shift your mindset, and step into a healthy relationship with your team. If you're ready to do things differently, tune in and join the movement.
Jeff Wald is the founder of WorkMarket, an enterprise software platform that enables companies to manage freelancers. Jeff has founded several other technology companies, including Spinback, a social sharing platform. He began his career in finance, serving as managing director at activist hedge fund Barrington Capital Group, a vice president at venture capital firm Glenrock, and various roles in the M&A group at J.P. Morgan. Jeff is an active angel investor and startup advisor, as well as serving on numerous public and private boards and directors. He also formerly served as an officer in the auxiliary unit of the New York Police Department. He is the author of The Birthday Rules and the Amazon bestseller of The End Jobs, The Rise of On-Demand Workers and Agile Corporations. He frequently speaks at conferences and in media on startups and labor issues.
Jeff Wald, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I can't wait to get started in this conversation because you're such an expert on the future of work. And just talking to you prior to this recording, you're sharing your journey in your own employment and all the great things that you've done. I think the work that you're doing is brilliant and from a perspective of having been in the workforce as well. So it's not just a bunch of academia.
That is true. I've had my own ups and downs professionally. I always say, what advice would you give to people that are going to start a company? Because I've started four. I would say, well, if you're going to have one fail and have it basically bankrupt you, have that be the first of your companies.
Yes.
It's the best advice I can give, because having done four, it was the first one that left me basically broke. Luckily, the next three worked to varying degrees of success.
The gift wasn't just the bankruptcy, I'm sure. It was the learning opportunities that it provided for the other.
Yeah, I'll tell you this, Rosa. That's what everybody said when you're going through it. They're like, oh, you're going to look back on this. And I'm like, yeah, you know, blank off, man. About that. You know, it'd be great to have my money back. You can't really hear it when you want to hear it or when it's important to hear.
Right.
Your reaction is, no, that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is that I'm a failure and I lost all my money. Mm-hmm, but they are right. That wisdom exists and propagates through the generations for reasons. You will learn more from that failure than you will learn in any other circumstance. And I certainly did.
And do you find yourself with a deeper conviction because of that experience?
Conviction, maybe. I mean, resolve might be a different word. I find myself with more compassion than I had before. I found myself with more humility than I had before. And I found myself with more gratitude than I had before. So there were certainly a lot of changes for me professionally and personally going through that very long valley.
No, that's beautiful. And so with that kind of passion and that approach, you have written a book. Let's talk about that.
Well, I'll tell you this. My last company called WorkMarket, we were super lucky. We raised money from the best venture capitalists, Union Square Ventures, SoftBank. We sold the company to ADP, one of the largest companies in the world. Everyone thinks of ADP as a payroll company. They're actually one of the largest software companies in the world. And it was amazing. I mean, it gave me a lot of space to give talks on the on-demand economy. WorkMarket specifically was software that helps companies manage their freelancers. And so I get asked to go to all these conferences and panels and speeches. And it was such an honor and I loved it. But I'll tell you this, it got very frustrating for someone like me who is very evidence-driven, very data grounded. And you'd hear other people talk and they'd be like, oh, I think this is going to happen. That's going to happen. You're like, no, that's not at all possible. Why is someone giving this person a microphone? Take the microphone away from him. He should not be talking. That's a ridiculous statement. And it got to the point where I would get pretty combative on panels. And that didn't go away, by the way. That happened literally just like a couple of weeks ago. I was on a panel and this guy says, well, I think 50% of the US workforce is going to work remotely post-COVID. Everyone's like, oh, interesting. I'm like, I'm sorry. I have to interrupt here. How do you juxtapose that with the fact that only 42% of the U.S. workforce can work remotely? Because people in transportation and entertainment and logistics, in manufacturing, and in a host of other industries can't. And he said, oh, I didn't know that was, I'm like, yeah, shouldn't you know it though? if you're going to be out there making predictions. And so I'm not 100% sure that I'll be asked back to that particular group since that was the CEO of the company that was on that panel, but that's okay. Look, the point here is that I would go to these things and I would get very frustrated because I, again, am very evidence driven. And I thought, you know what? We have these huge bodies of evidence. We have the history of work. We have the data in the world of work, and we have how companies actually engage workers. And if we look at those things and we study them, I'm not saying that it gives me any kind of crystal ball. I'm saying that if we look at those things, we have a much higher probability of making predictions that actually have a chance of coming true. They're based in the history of how these things have happened over the last 200 years. And we all know history tends to rhyme. They're
Right.
based in data, and they look at the existing data patterns, and they aren't anomalies in data patterns, which tend almost never to happen. They're based on what the CHROs and C-suites of some of the largest companies in the world are doing. Because just because someone can do something doesn't mean they will do it. And they think about the regulatory environment and a host of other factors. So when we look at those things, we are able to make higher probability predictions. And that's what we hope to do with the book, The End of Jobs. The reaction's been great. We were number one in all of Amazon's HR categories when we came out, which was super fun.
Well, I can tell you from coming from an investigative background myself, there's nothing that beats working with the facts and instead of assumptions and dreams and just a basic lack of effort to investigate. So I want to hear some of these predictions that you have. And obviously we encourage the readers to pick up the book and go and read it for themselves and to study it. But let's talk a little bit about that because one of the things we're affected by is COVID, the impact to the workforce where people are sitting at home wondering what it's going to be like. They're uncertain. We have a young generation coming into a workforce that doesn't even exist for them in some cases. And they're training and preparing for careers that they don't even know that are going to be there. So let's talk about some of the things that might help that uncertainty.
Well, focus a little bit on remote work, right? The world of work is so vast. It touches so many aspects of our lives, of companies, of job functions. So we really need to focus each discussion on a very specific area. Let's do remote work, as you've brought up. So, shocking nobody that's been listening, let's start with some history and some data. 10 years ago, 1.5% of the US workforce worked remotely. Now, definitions are important. Remote work means more than 50% of the time you are not going to a company office, which is very important from a tax nexus standpoint and an office infrastructure standpoint. If you're only showing up here 30% of the time, I don't need to allocate square footage to you. You can hot desk or hotel desk. So 1.5% in 2010. From 2010 to 2020, it grew by 100%,
Wow.
went from 1.5% to 3% of the workforce. That is very unusual in the world of labor statistics and only happens when two things are there. One is you start from a very low base, which the 1.5% is certainly a low number. And two, there is an enabling technology. And for remote work, it was the Zooms and WebEx and GoToMeetings before them. It was project management software like Trello and Asana and Basecamp that allowed people to work on the same project in different locations. And those two things enabled us to get to 3%. And pre-pandemic, we would have said, look, that 3% is probably going to go to 4%, maybe 5% over the next 10 years, because the numbers are starting to get bigger. So they're not going to double again. It's very difficult to double. And two, there were huge impediments to the remote work world advancing more rapidly. One was mindset. And we all know the boss that says, yeah, I know all the studies say that remote workers are happier, they're healthier, they're more productive, they're more engaged, they have higher retention rates, but I think productivity equals presence. We all know that person. So that mindset was a huge impediment to the growth of the remote workforce. And second was infrastructure and policies and procedures. It's one thing to say, Rosa, no problem, you can work remotely. It's another to make sure that there are remote meeting options for every single meeting. It's another to make sure you can access all of the company's systems if you're not within the company's four walls. Because you can't work remotely if you can't access anything and all the stuff you need to get your job done. So those were two huge impediments. And in March of 2020, both of them got swept away by COVID. COVID forced a change of mindset, and it forced policies, procedures, and infrastructures to enable remote work immediately. Because those things happened, we now see a future where remote work will be about 8% of the labor force. People usually have a reaction when I say 8%. They're like, oh, 8%, that's not enough. I'm like, okay, slow down. First, let's remember the natural limit is 42%. So that's 8% of 42%, or almost 20% of the people that can work remotely will. That is huge.
Right.
Let's remember moving from 3% to 8% is almost 8 million incremental workers working remotely. Let's remember our definition of remote work. If you go to the office 3 days a week, you are not a remote worker. Mm-hmm. You are what is called a flexible worker. And if you ask me how many people have a flexible work arrangement, which is by far what the surveys say most people want, most people don't want to go fully remote. Most people don't want to be back in the office 9 to 5. 90%+ of people want a flexible work arrangement. Flexible work arrangement is you're not 9 to 5. You're coming in 3 days a week, 4 days a week, 3 weeks a month, whatever it is. That will be 33% to 34% of the U.S. workforce. Again, remembering 42% is a natural limit. Now you're talking about upwards of 75% of the people that can work in a flexible environment will. So that's kind of what we see in the world of remote work about how COVID has impacted it. We see how companies actually engage workers because we think about different job functions and which they may do. And we look at the data and we look at history. And that's how we can kind of have a discussion that is thoughtful, that has a high probability of being correct. Is it going to be 8% and 33%, or will it be 7% and 35%? Who knows? But it is directionally where we will end up post-COVID.
And that's a really healthy way to set the foundation for the next question, which is, basically, for people who do want that flex schedule, they might be encouraged to know that that's the majority of people, that they can have an office setting with a team and work with other people and not be in isolation at home. You can have it all. You can have the best of both worlds.
You can have the best of both worlds. Look, there was very little reason to bring people together 9 to 5, 5 days a week. There is very good reason to bring people together often. There is very good reason from both the company's standpoint, in terms of serendipity, in terms of creativity, in terms of communication, and a host of other things, building trust, building team dynamics, all of those things much better in person. And there are important reasons for us as people. We're a social animal. We actually don't want to be locked away in our homes, even if it's with our friends and family and loved ones. We, you know, want to get out of there every now and again. And so when I talk to companies about how they're adjusting to remote work, whether they think productivity is increased or decreased. And again, you need to think about these things industry by industry, job function by job function. Some companies think it's great and they're going to be like, hey, you can be fully remote, you can be flexible, you can come to the office, whatever you want. Other companies are going to say, yeah, we don't dig this. Everybody come back in. And okay, you don't need to be 9 to 5, but for the most part, it's 9 to 5 and all kinds of places in between. And when I advise them, I just said, remember, whatever productivity you're seeing, remember that the people that are working remotely right now are dealing with a pandemic. So there's depression, there's social isolation, there's fear, there's anxiety that's impacting their work. They're acting as childcare or teachers, elder care. There are a host of things that they are not able to do to be as productive. So when companies are like, oh, I don't think people have been that productive, I'm like, yeah, okay, well, let's run this experiment again. When there isn't a pandemic going on, because they're really close to the levels of productivity you had before. So let's be cautious about the conclusions within a specific time frame.
That's great to invite leaders and business owners to actually be sober-minded in their decisions, because I think we all find security in the known, and we all view this current reality as a temporary reality. But I think that we can step into this new reality and embrace it and really help the workforce to grow and be more satisfied. I think that's the biggest interruption that I see here, is that people are realizing they want to be led better. They want to be encouraged to grow and invested in more and appreciated more. I think the days of just come in here and give us your life and then retire and go into the sunset, like I think those days can be over. I think we would welcome that.
It is true. It is true. And this is something we go out into in the book. Because what you're alluding to, you tell me if I'm mishearing, is kind of that lifetime employment model that companies used to talk about. And I'll tell you, often I get asked to participate in debates. Is the new way of work better? Was it better before? Get into debates about the on-demand economy. Everyone thinks, oh, on-demand's terrible and workers hate it and companies are just taking advantage. In these debates, people always reference, for some reason, IBM in the 1960s. I don't know why that particular company. I don't know why that particular time frame. They say, oh, it didn't used to be this way. To which I would say, based on what? What are you saying that? Like, well, that's the way companies used to employ workers. And I'll say, okay, let me ask you this. The average amount of time an employee spends in a job today is 4.1 years. It was 4.2 about 2 years ago, went down to 4.1.
you know, a lot of the workforce, especially blue collar work, is represented by unions. What would you speak to that?
Well, hopefully surprising nobody that's been listening, let's talk about a little history and a little data here. So the union movement is really fascinating to study the history of the union movement, because when you think about how the workforce changes, how the supply and demand balance changes, how the power balance between companies and workers change when you go through these industrial revolutions. And we've had three, and a lot of people call the robots and AI the fourth industrial revolution. It's very interesting to look at what happens. What happens is a new technology comes on stream: mechanization, electrification, computerization, or robots and AI. Those are our four industrial revolutions. The power balance shifts massively to companies, because companies get this new tech that massively increases productivity. And what do? They kind of screw the workers. I mean, let's be honest, right?
Yes.
We can go through the Pullman strikes, the Triangle factory fire, which people may remember from their history books. They may not remember the Battle of Blair Mountain or the Ludlow Massacre, but given their names, you can guess how those turned out for workers.
Right.
So there have to be counterbalancing forces that rise, because you can't have this imbalance for that long. It won't persist. Society won't accept it. And the counterbalancing forces for workers are generally regulation, the social safety net, and unions. And so late in the second industrial revolution, unions started to rise. And they stayed at about 10% of the labor force until the New Deal. The New Deal put in place the National Labor Relations Act, and that took union membership up from 10 to about 30% post-war. And then it went into a slow and steady decline, in line with the decline in manufacturing in the United States in a lot of ways. And the union movement has actually not lost members. There have been about 15 million members of the union over the last 20 to 30 years. It's just new workers joining the workforce aren't joining unions. And so union membership will slowly decline over time as people retire. But union, people think, oh, union membership's declined. No, union membership's about the same. It's just the workforce is growing. And therefore, as a percent of the workforce, we're down to about 7% now. From its peak at 30, we're down to about 7. So when we think about the fourth industrial revolution, you can anticipate an increase in the union movement because of it. Now, we just saw in Bessemer, Alabama, Amazon beat the union as the unions tried to put in place a union in the warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, and they lost that vote almost 2-1. So you might say, oh, are the unions really resurgent? Yes, the unions really will be resurgent. One setback doesn't define a trend. Union sentiment, positive view people have of unions, has never been higher than it is in the United States right now. And you see other types of movements. Are you familiar with the Fight for 15?
No.
So the Fight for 15 started out of the union movement in Seattle, the SEIU, the Service Employment International's union, led by the brilliant David Rolfe. They started this movement to say, look, $15, that is the bare minimum we need to be paying a human being so that they can live. And the federal minimum wage, I believe, is $7.25. In most states, it is slightly higher. Some states stay at the $7.25. And they said, we need to push in the city of Seattle for a $15 minimum wage, a living wage. That movement took hold all across the United States by non-union activists, grassroots activists, workers united in common cause, not in the same companies, not even in the same industries. Many of them earning well above $15 an hour, that just simply said, yeah, this is right. We can't have people making less than $15 an hour. That is unacceptable. So they helped pass legislation. And I believe the count is 14 states now that are slowly moving towards a $15 minimum wage. You can't just make that change overnight. You can't go from 7 to 15. That is unreasonable for a host of reasons. And we have a president and an administration that now has a major part of what they'd like to accomplish for the American worker, a federal $15 an hour minimum wage. That is insane that that has happened that quickly. And that is all because of workers united in a common cause is a evolution of the union movement. These are people using social media and fighting for rights of workers all across this country. That is what the unions were always designed to do, was to use this collective action. They've just found a new way to do it, using social media. So the union movement itself, it may stay at 7% of the labor force, maybe even decline. But workers uniting in common cause, that won't go away, and you will see a massive increase in it and in social activity on that front.
I hope you're enjoying this episode of Powerful at Work Radio. I'm your host, Rosa Ponce de Leon. And if you're ready for more freedom from the day-to-day so you can properly rest, dream, and be more effective as a business owner, I want to invite you to our upcoming free training where I'm going to share my easy 5-part process for making sure your team feels truly seen and heard. For more details or to register for the training, visit rosaponcedeleon.com. Thank you for listening. If you haven't subscribed already, do yourself a favor and hit subscribe. Then head over to rosaponcedeleon.com where you'll find tons of resources for growing as a business owner so you can go all in on your team while they go all in on bringing your vision to life.
Well, that's a beautiful place to transition into something I love to talk about, which is leadership and culture, because if the workforce can revamp the way we do work, and it's not just a leadership crisis issue that we need to fix, it can also be a workforce issue that we teach workers or we remind workers that they have a lot of power in what they can demand. And by demand, I mean, they're not demanding anything extraordinary. That's fair what they're demanding, right? It's fair to be treated properly. It's fair to be led properly. Culture is one of those things that I consider in your context of counterbalancing those corporation advantages as a huge measure that would basically make the environment better for the workforce. What can you say to culture?
Well, I'll tell you this. When people ask me, what are the biggest mistakes you made building Work Market? Now look, we had a great outcome. My investors made money. My team made money. ADP loves the product. ADP's customers love it. So it's all good. I don't mean to say that, you know, we made too many mistakes, but that being said, we made a ton of mistakes. I would tell you that the biggest mistake I made was that we did not have a culture document. And to me, a culture document means you are very clear about 4 very important things: who you are, why you're there, where you're going, and what you stand for. So the who you are, that one sentence that says who you are to your team, to the outside world, the why you're here, your mission. Why does your team get out of bed every morning and come in? What are you fighting for? Where are you going? What is that North Star? Where are you leading this team? Where do you want this team in 5 years and 10 years? And what you stand for, what are your values? This, though, Rosa, is where a lot of companies drop the ball, is they do those in some variation, but then they don't enumerate what are the policies, procedures, and behaviors that back all that stuff up. Because otherwise, they're just words on a wall. If you say that a value of yours is transparency, but everyone's got a closed door and closed calendars and nobody, no, then you're not transparent and your employees will recognize the lack of authenticity and you're going to have a problem. So what are the behaviors? What are the policies that back that stuff up? This became illuminated to me when ADP was buying us, and ADP being, again, one of the largest companies in the world, they had about a team of 7,000 people doing diligence on our little company and going through everything. And I was getting one of my, you know, nothing like somebody going deep up into everything you've ever done over the last 7.5 years and asking you questions about it. And they came and sat down with me going through some readouts on things. And they said, we've asked all of your employees, what is Work Market? That first thing, who you are, what is Work Market? And they had 72 different answers.
Wow.
And you can imagine the confusion that causes, because people thought we were something that I knew we were not. Mm. And that is no one's fault but mine. That is them being poorly led. That is them being out there making decisions, talking to customers, talking to the users of the platform, and saying things that we couldn't do and wouldn't do, but they thought we did. Imagine the kind of disincentive. Imagine how dissuading that is. How demoralizing that is as a team member, where you tell a customer, yeah, we can do that. And then you come and you're like, all right, we need to do this for the customer. And other people are like, what? We don't do that. And other people are like, no, you can't tell the customer that. Now you're like, oh, why did I say that? Now you get it. It's all terrible.
Confusion. Yeah.
A lot of confusion. And so when you think about the remote workforce, when you think about a changing workforce, if you have that trust, and that trust can come from a well-defined culture document, you are much more likely to be able to allow people to bring their authentic selves to work. If people really feel comfortable with who they are much more likely to be able to do that constructive conflict where you get all the brains in your team working. And if they're all doing that and they all know they're rowing in the same direction, but they're all bringing their own perspective and their own strengths, oh my gosh, you will be so much better off. I think there's a great study to be done. If I were back in business school, I would spend some time researching this, but I'm in the real world now and have to earn a living. We can't do that. But any business school students out there, let's get in touch. You can do this project of looking at companies that have well-defined culture documents and looking at their performances over time. And I would bet everything I have that companies that have a well-defined culture document that build cultures of trust have performed better.
Yeah, and I would obviously look at, first of all, the fact that the document is there. You're right, absolutely right. That's a start because most people don't give it the importance it needs. But really the proactiveness of that leader in engaging that document on a daily basis in everyday operations, engaging people and enforcing those dynamics of conflict and of healthy conversations between employees, and just having that psychological safety that every employee needs in order to innovate and take risks for the company. I think those two things together, the proper leadership and the document itself, are absolutely fundamental.
I am with you. And look, that document, it's a living, breathing document. It should be shared. It should be constantly updated. And it isn't for everybody. We were very transparent.
Right.
We were very open and we were very focused on learning. And if you weren't there to push your own boundaries, if you weren't there to learn, you shouldn't be there. And that's fine. Some people don't want that.
You
if
you
don't
want
it,
fit somewhere else.
Yeah, get the heck out. Go fit someplace else. I don't want you on my team. So it's better for everybody. And to your point, if you are using that document to really lead on a day-to-day basis, that's what builds authenticity and trust. Because again, the conflict is, if you say we value creative collaboration and constructive conflict, and you have the brilliant jerk that is just super smart and a high performer, but doesn't play well with others, and that person keeps getting promoted, then you're not being authentic. That person, if that's your culture, has to go. I don't care how brilliant they are. They have to go. That was a tough decision that, you know, we made, letting go some brilliant jerks. They're amazing, but they weren't fitting with our culture. If you start to become disingenuous within your culture, you will start to lose on a number of fronts.
I can't think of any better way to close, and I know we could probably talk forever, but I really think we've hit a lot and given our audience a lot to think about. For those that are interested in hearing more from you, in addition to the book, how might we connect?
Well, the Twitter platform is the only place that I go by Jeffrey, because I could not get Jeff Wald. Just couldn't get it. I'm going to find who's got it. Or you can just go to jeffwald.com. LinkedIn is by far my preferred social network.
Beautiful. We'll go ahead and include those in the show notes. Thank you so much, Jeff Wald, for your insight and your passionate research that is enlightening all of us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Powerful at Work Radio. If you subscribe now, you're going to hear from some truly amazing guests who will help you shift into a new approach to leadership so you can develop a healthy relationship with your team and truly maximize your impact. We'll explore stories from experts who are daring to do work differently, and we want to invite you to the conversation. So just hit that little subscribe button on your podcast app, and don't forget to leave us a review. We're excited to help you lead a high-performance team with simple advice that you can start using now for maximum results.